Some time ago, my identity got stolen. My digital privacy was intruded as someone or something created a fake Instagram account that used my name and had my face as a profile picture. This fake account then started to post pictures of me that were publicly downloadable from different sources. Most of them were my previous profile pictures from Facebook and Instagram. I was one of the first persons that this fake account contacted by starting to follow my actual Instagram account. So the intention of all this seemed to be just to get my attention and just to kind of pick on me. In a way, it was just a minor intrusion. These kinds of things happen every day, and many people I know have experienced something similar or something much worse. I reported the fake account to Instagram and it was deleted the next day. But this was, and is, by far not the only kind of misuse or intrusion of our digital privacy that's going on. At this very moment, we are being tracked in more ways we can imagine. My name is Jukka Vahti and this is Rise to Shine Futures podcast that's produced by Sitra, the Finnish Future Fund. In this podcast, we are not afraid to ask big questions and we are not afraid of the future. In this episode, we aim to find answers to the question, who's exploiting my data and what can we do about it? In the first part of this episode, I'll talk with a colleague of mine, Tiina Härkönen, who is a leading specialist at Sitra. And with her, we'll talk, among other things, about a really interesting DigiTrail survey made by Sitra just recently. Welcome to the Futures podcast, Tiina.
Thank you very much.
In the latter part of this episode, I'll talk with Mr. Paul-Olivier Dieu, who is a Swiss-based mathematician, data expert, and personal data activist, who is known, among other things, for his expertise on Cambridge Analytica, a company that was caught aiming to influence national elections in different countries, basically all around the world, by misusing data gathered from Facebook and other sources. Paul Olivier has also founded a non-profit organization called Personal Data IO. Now let's start with a quote.
You'd need an expert to explain the nature of the world in which your data flows. You can't really comprehend it on your own.
This quote was from one of the six test persons whose data flows were followed with their permission and analyzed in the DigiTrail survey conducted by Sitra just recently. Tiina, you work at the Fair Data Economy project at Sitra. In regard to the quote from the DigiTrail test person we just heard, what do you think? How well do people understand how their data and data regarding themselves is being used at the moment?
I think there are so many different ways to use internet and the digital services. So there are many levels of understanding as well. I think most of us sort of understand. We know that our data is gathered, but we don't really understand properly the implications. Also, we don't know about the systemic problem behind that data gathering. And if we talk about people that are maybe elderly or children, their understanding is very limited. Since children have problems with understanding correlations or the long-term effects of their data use.
Well, I suppose this certain intransparency in the use of data actually highlights the need for some talk on what are we actually talking about. As this DigiTrail survey showed, our data seems to have a whole secret life of its own. How would you define the term data economy?
Data economy is a very big term because that entails things such as platform economy that we normally talk about, But data economy is anything that has data in its core. So if we make business from data, of data, that's part of data economy. So creating products and services based on data.
And I suppose it's something that's growing rapidly as technology kind of will be embedded in almost everything in our everyday lives. So data economy is something that surrounds us in many ways.
Yeah, in the olden days, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we talked about data in gigabytes. Nowadays, it's zettabytes, which is trillion gigabytes that we create data per year. So the amounts of data, that's something that we simply can't comprehend any longer.
As mentioned before, Sitra has just published this so-called Digitrail survey, in which the aim was to find out what happens to our data as we surf online with our smartphones, and also to find out what kinds of data flows there are. What was the most important result from this survey, in your opinion?
To me, it was really worrying to understand what we don't understand. The problem is that there is a very, very complex opaque ecosystem behind the gathering of our data. The problem is that we don't have a relationship with these companies that we call third parties. There are hundreds and hundreds of different companies behind the web services that we think we are using that gather our data. And the opaqueness is a problem since we don't know where our data flows and what do these organizations do with our data.
So the most important result was to find out what we do not know.
Exactly. Also, the complexity of the ecosystems is such that even the experts have difficulties in understanding all the different roles and players in that ecosystem. So when we understand that something is this complex, we also understand that we have to do something about it. Because if nobody really understands what's happening behind the scenes, how can we regulate that? How can we control that? How can we make sure that people have their privacy? And to me, when some organizations or people say that privacy is dead, that, you know, forget about it, get over it, I'm absolutely convinced that that's not the case, because that depends on the things we do. We may have lost our privacy for the time being, but we have all the power to define what the future brings.
Yes, and I suppose we should have some say in the privacy issues that concern all of us.
Absolutely. We're talking about human rights here.
To talk about what there is to do in order to make things better, Sitra, with its partners both in Finland and abroad, are aiming to turn this current model of data economy around into something that's called the fair data economy. If this goal will be accomplished, what would change in comparison to the current situation?
Well, fair data is using data with an individual's consent. So that bases on a joint agreement between the individual and the company offering the service. It's also based on trust and shared ethical principles. We already know that the lack of trust is somewhat affecting the use of digital services. When people don't trust, they decrease the use of some digital services. We hope to rebuild the trust and then people will be able to freely use the services and trust the companies that are building all these fair data services. So, of course, that also means that people can decide the terms which define the ways a company can use a person's data. And it must be made easy for the individual to understand the ways the data is used and the ways they can manage the data. And when we talk about trust, we also talk about trust between different companies, not just the individuals and the companies, because we feel that the amount of data is important and the variety of data is equally important. And we get there when companies trust each other, create ecosystems where they can have data partnerships and share data. There we can see that new FAIR database innovations and services emerge. So that's when all the players, the individual, the business, as well as the society, benefit from these services.
So to put it in a nutshell, we should aim to go from the current situation, which is quite monopolistic, data giant-driven data economy, into the data economy of ecosystems, where there is more transparency and data flows freely.
Absolutely. And the problem at the moment is that the biggest companies benefit. We call them big tech companies. We also talk about ad tech when we talk about digital advertising. And so what we need to ensure is that the SME companies benefit as well, so that the data from individuals, for example, is not gathered and put in silos where we European organizations cannot reach them, because data is food for innovation. Hence, we need to get access to huge amounts of data with the consent of the individuals when talking about services based on personal data.
So it seems that you believe that another kind of digital world is possible.
It's absolutely possible. We, the people, may create that new future. We know that there is space for a new kind of data economy business model. That's something which is between the American business model, where companies, huge corporations, benefit or rule the world, so to speak. Then there is this Chinese model where the state is in control. We believe there is space for a European way to do this, which is to give enough data for companies for innovation, yet respect the privacy of the individuals so that we get the consent from the individuals for these services.
Okay, that's good to hear. Thanks for taking the time to visit the Futures podcast.
Thank you.
Now it's time for the latter part of this episode, where we'll talk with Mr. Paul-Olivier Douy. Welcome to the Futures podcast, Paul.
Thank you.
You have helped Sitra to analyze the results from this DigiTrail survey mentioned before. What's your insights on the survey? Were there any surprises in the results from your perspective?
Well, it confirms that surveillance is really pervasive online, that there are many different trackers that are present on the websites. This study was interesting because it combined different techniques together. Simultaneously, a technical audit, trying to see how citizens were using the web, like kind of spying on them with their knowledge, of course, but also trying to investigate the transparency tools that were put at disposal of individuals to better establish, to better understand what the consequences were in terms of profiling.
So there were different angles that could be taken through this test. It was not just technical, but it was also how people behave and what they think about this whole thing.
Right. So that was the idea, was to try to assess as much as possible of what was going on and then share that back with them and also see their reactions. That's actually really important, because often in the current version of this data economy, it's based on this idea that people consent to this. Yeah, they clicked, I agree, they somehow agree to this. But then in reality, they have no awareness of the extent of the surveillance that takes place. And so having these loops where you actually assess as much as you can what is going on, and then you show that back to the individual, and you show that basically their expectations were completely violated, that's really important, because it destroys this fiction that currently the data world functions on consent.
As mentioned in the beginning of this episode, you are looking at the data economy and personal data rights issues from the perspective of a mathematician. and you're originally from Belgium and currently living in Switzerland. Why and how did you originally got interested in questions relating to data and data protection rights?
Well, it's a long story, but I progressively felt more and more uneasy about it over time. Uneasy about the surveillance, uneasy about this transfer of power, essentially, that every single personal data transaction amounts to. But for a while, it was just something I was curious about, like you would be curious following a subject. But I was a professor at the University of Zurich, and at some point, these online courses appeared where universities would put their courses online to teach students. There was like the platform approach to higher education, and that led me to look at these topics also with a professional eye. And combining my perspective of mathematician, looking at systems, looking more broadly, really to question it and essentially to shift career, I guess.
So it wasn't some single occurrence or something that happened that kind of opened your eyes and led you to this path. It was just a kind of a curiosity based on what you were doing.
Well, the curiosity was informed by different things. I mean, over time and sustained, the Snowden revelations were pretty important to me, because also, you know, there's crypto systems that are built by mathematicians. Actually, no, they are building theory of how crypto systems should be built. And you see that how that's rolled out in the real world is much more subtle than that, because there's all kinds of influence corrupting those abstract models. So that was an element. Another one was, well, it's trivial, but and I'm maybe making a big deal out of it 15 years later, or maybe 20 years later. But when I started my PhD in the US, very quickly after that, I got arrested for something trivial, which was to be drunk in public, basically. And that actually didn't cause any problem for close to 10 years. But 10 years later, somehow the US must have merged two databases. And that started to become an obstacle for me entering easily into the US. And so that means I had to wait for hours and hours to get into the country and meet a lot of other people in similar situations. And, you know, each time I enter in the US, it's like, oh, I'm a mathematician. I go to a conference and I'm highly educated. I'm white. I have a significant amount of advantages that will not make this a painful thing. I mean, not more painful than just waiting for a few hours. But other people are not in that situation. And it's just a bit somewhere in a database, but it does have significant effect on some people.
Yes, and I think that's a good example of how we really can't see what's being done with our data and how it's affecting our lives. This path of yours has since taken you to investigate Cambridge Analytica, among other things, and you've been heard as an expert in relation to Facebook Cambridge Analytica data scandal, both in the British Parliament and in the European Parliament. How did you end up being an expert on this topic?
Well, some might contest it as well. it's just like when I saw in December 2015 an article about Cambridge Analytica written by Harry Davies in The Guardian, as soon as I saw it, I knew, like, okay, this is like Snowden, but for commercial surveillance. And I was waiting for follow-up articles from him, but they just never came. And it turns out he had left The Guardian very quickly afterwards. And so around February 2016, I thought, well, okay, then I'll just investigate myself. And I started looking at it in detail. And very quickly, you could find a lot of things when you broke apart the Cambridge Analytica corporate structure. You had other names of companies to look for, and you could find quite a lot of information very quickly. And then I had all my knowledge of technical systems and legal systems, and somehow that combined into being quite potent to help journalists investigate this.
And I suppose this is a scandal that's still going on as new documents are being sent through Twitter. And I think that in the last few months, we've seen that we haven't seen it all yet. Or what do you think?
Yeah, so there is two big angles where stuff can, well, three, let's say three. where stuff is still happening. So the first angle is indeed the release of more documents by Brittany Kaiser, who was an employee in the company. So basically she has managed to recover some emails from the time she was working there, and she's releasing those. There is what's called a subject access request filed by David Carroll, who is this professor in the US that I helped get his data from Cambridge Analytica, or start to get his data from Cambridge Analytica, using UK privacy laws. So basically the laws before GDPR, the now European laws. And so he got some of his data, but not everything. But now we know that the UK Data Protection Authority has the servers, they've seized servers, they have the password, and they are analyzing his data. And they are going at some point to release this, but they are like months behind schedule now. And then the third strand, which is somehow, I still don't understand why, but not pushed more, is all the data we need to understand what happened is actually on Facebook's servers. And they are refusing to release any of it, to open it up for third parties to analyze, to mine. They've just basically said, you know, we're a different company in 2016. Now we've fixed all the problems, trust us, and let's not revisit the past. Which is, I mean, I'm very surprised people are accepting that. That seems to be the case.
That might be a good example of the data economy we are living in at the moment. And maybe we'll get back to the questions of democracy in the end of this episode. But just to get back to this DigiTrail survey that Citra has just published, Citra has also published a so-called DigiProfile test, which is naturally online and can be found on Citra's webpage. And with this test, anyone can figure out their own DigiProfile and measure their own data economy awareness. I believe you just took this test, and what was the result for you?
So apparently I'm a doubtful data pro.
What does that mean?
Well, I guess the name is there. I have some awareness of tools and techniques of surveillance, and that informs how I approach digital services, so kind of with a critical eye and doubtful eye. I could be aware of being tracked and then just having given up, or be grateful for this because it helps personalize my services. But instead, I'm doubtful.
Yeah, I did the test too, and my profile was closest to suspicious. I don't trust that my own actions matter. Big companies do what they want. Maybe I'll need to adjust my attitude a little bit, but that was the test result for me, and maybe I'll have to do it again after our discussion if I have better faith then.
But that's what's good about the test, right? I mean, it's there to try to equip you with some more information, and then you see. That's kind of the way it should work, where individuals ultimately make their own decisions.
What's your general insight on the future of data economy? Is there a reason to be optimist or a pessimist? Do you think that this fair data economy is actually possible?
Well, I find reasons to be optimist. Certainly the subject is being talked about more. More powerful people think it's more important now. Also, I'm quite convinced that over time, investigations like the one we just did will get easier because enforcement will improve. And so we'll get more transparency. I'm also quite hopeful, quite convinced, actually, that transparency is pretty toxic to some of those business models. It can really have an impact, not directly on the companies doing the most toxic profiling, but on most companies that you actually know spend a lot of money on their brand, on advertising their brand and projecting a certain image. And so they will be wary of associating themselves with the most toxic profiling companies. I'm quite convinced this will happen. And also, so all of those are fairly negative motivations, I guess. But on the positive side, there is also the fact that I'm quite convinced, and I'm trying to quantify this, but it's very hard, that there is a lot more value in having an economy around data more centered on the individual. And there's just so much more richness in this data when it crosses different contexts, different thresholds. But of course, when it's done without the approval of the individual, it amounts to a privacy invasion. And that has a lot of value for the company that is abusing the privacy of the individual. That's how they make money. But the individual does get robbed of something that they consider a value, which is their privacy, that they didn't necessarily intend to monetize. So the tricky bit now is to show to people the value they can get out of this aggregation on their own side, but without entering into very basic monetary relationship where they just get robbed of this value.
At the end of last year, we did a Futures podcast episode with the title, How Can I Create Systems Change? And in that episode, we talked about societal innovations and societal change. As far as I can see, the question of fair data economy is also kind of a systemic change level challenge, as the aim is to change the whole paradigm of how this economy works. Do you think that the change will be made from the grassroots level, bottom up, or from the top down, through, for example, new legislation? I suppose that the European level GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, that was implemented in 2018 was one important push towards systems change, or was it?
Yes, it's the first part of a push. There needs to be a second part. And actually, it's not a legislative second push, but it's a regulatory one. It's like an enforcement one. That's what's missing, according to me, now. So you're right. It is a system change. I very much see it that way. Mathematicians, when they study their objects, they know that a very important thing is to study the relations between objects. You can learn a lot more about them in this way. The links. And I know that the circular economy is a big topic for Citra. And when we discuss that, we discuss shortening of supply chains. We really see those links between companies and we see goods transiting through those links and we see a whole circle and we want to reduce it and make it more local. It's kind of similar with personal data in the personal data economy. That's kind of what we want to do. And I think the change that is needed now is for regulators to see it that way as well. Because if they do, then they do start aligning with the forces that individuals and businesses can mobilize locally. We start sharing the same language of how we can create the change between all the local actors who actually want to make the situation better. And so that becomes very powerful because there is a real alignment locally that ends up being against something that affects all of them negatively.
Do you see this transformation as mostly technological or cultural in nature, or how should we look at it?
Well, there's certainly going to be technical components, there's legal components, all of this stuff. But I think it all derives from really a cultural one, which is that we build up the language to talk about those things, right? So about what is a privacy invasion, how do you create value? And it's all about these links and these transfers of data and this processing of data that changes it and enhances its capabilities. So we need to complexify our language around that.
And I suppose that's closely linked to what you said earlier about the businesses and the companies who kind of need to see this as a reputation matter,
yep,
and a matter of brand on how they do business.
Yeah, that's part of it. And that's also what I was seeing with the Cambridge Analytica story early on when I said it's like Snowden. It's like I knew this could be a cultural shift because it would change the way we perceive privacy as from a private good, from something that an individual should care about, but some people don't care about because they share all the pictures on Instagram and so on, to more like a public good that is important to preserve collectively because it's tied to sovereignty of states in relation to the autonomy of their citizens. So it's very complex, but it shifts the responsibility away from the individual to the collective. And that is a real cultural change because it changes everything else downstream.
If you look at the field of data economy globally, if you look at the big picture, I suppose it can be seen that there are at least three different models of data economy at the moment in the world. We have this Silicon Valley American model we deal with every day with these data giants. And then we have this kind of a Chinese model with very tight surveillance and control. And maybe the third one could be this European model of the fair data economy. How do you see this play field at the moment, and how do you think it will evolve?
So this model, or this tripartite model, is helpful up to a certain point. So we have to be careful. We don't want the Chinese totalitarian model. We don't want the boundaryless American model. And probably the Americans are now realizing that that's not working out so well for them. But we have to be careful with the European one, not to be too, too much looking at our own belly button, too much centered on the individual. It's great that individuals have decision about their own data, but it's still a challenge to convince them that sharing some of it is worthwhile. I think it is worthwhile in most circumstances that are not monetary. When it's, for instance, about improving the transportation in the city, or health, or, you know, all kinds of really ultimately public goods. And so for all of those reasons, I think we shouldn't be thinking in a too limited way that there are three models and that's it. There are very interesting models that are being talked about in India, for instance, the biggest democracy in the world. Maybe we have, and that has more of a collective perspective on how data should be managed. So we should be listening or paying attention to what they're doing. There's also all these indigenous data movements that are very interesting all over the world, where you have basically indigenous people, their own perception of what a nation is that is equally valid to ours. And they have completely different ways of thinking about data. And those are really can be very enriching to us as well. So we should pay attention to all of those.
So we should be listening to others instead of just trying to make our own point.
Well, we shouldn't make our own point, but we should be open to it evolving, and we should find allies, simply said, right? We shouldn't seek to impose our own globally, and it's going to be a global problem. So,
a bit earlier you mentioned that the question of who gets to control the data is also a question of sovereignty. It's about controlling the future. It's about how do we want to develop our society and our lives. Thinking about Cambridge Analytica, do you think that knowing what you know about it, do you think it's possible to have fair election nowadays? Can we be sure that the elections we go through are, you know, fair?
Well, I think at the moment it's going to be very hard to imagine that. I mean, the reality is that most communication transits through platforms that are purely motivated by profit and that are implementing algorithmic systems that I think can be fairly easily gamed by a state actor with, you know, some staff and some money. So the reality is that I think external forces can influence an election by boosting a candidate that is technically feasible. And if you accept that premise, then it just completely messes up the whole electoral dynamics, because any candidate can come and say that some other candidate that is doing better than them is being helped by foreign interference. And we have no way of questioning this because the platforms are so opaque. So it just shifts the debate outside of the actual issues into some very nebulous area where we're just at a loss. We just don't know. And so that's yes, this is a danger in any election right now.
Is there anything we can do about it? The transparency of data, for example, is of course something that should be done, but anything else?
Yeah, I think that would be actually quite significant. Because just like your favorite, you know, brand, politicians, they thrive on that brand. And if you see a politician that says one thing one place and something else another place, or says one thing targeting a very specific demographic, then that politician will be exposed to some extent as being double-faced. Now, on its own, that's not enough, but it does provide more awareness, more understanding, more tools for collective sense-making of the dynamics around an election. And I think that would change the dynamics of coverage of an election, which is really important as well.
Now it's time for the tinfoil hat segment of the episode.
Aha.
In this segment, we take an alternative perspective at the episode's topic through some mad conspiracy theory, rumor, or a real threat. To be honest, this time it was kind of hard to get to the paranoid zone, since the topic of this episode, in a way, challenges the limits of one's imagination. There's so much unbelievable things going on already in regard to data. However, this is what I came up with. Do you think it's possible that Mark Zuckerberg is actually a spy sent to Earth by some alien race in order to gather as much data about the humankind as possible in preparation for conquering the world?
So I don't think he was sent by an alien race, no. But I do think that this data is valuable for many things, including surveillance or intelligence. So there is a lot of power associated with concentrating all that data.
Maybe the same question in a little bit more conservative way. In your opinion, what's driving the world's data giants today? What do you think that their vision of the future of the data economy might be?
The answers are really easy there. What's driving them? Profits and the vision, the statu quo. It's just keep on doing the same. It works for them. Certainly no challenge to the current business models.
The last question. If we think about the DigiTrail survey discussed earlier and the whole landscape of the data economy today, what are the most essential steps we should take next in order to start moving towards the fair data economy?
Maybe it's unexpected, but I would say share the survey, share the stuff that you found interesting in it with your friends, with people around you, your family, your friends, all of that. I personally think that the change towards a fairer data economy will not come top down, but will come bottom up, because more and more people together will, through friendship networks, will understand that this is really a problem. And actually, there is a lot of strength through these friendship networks, because you might have someone who is not that digitally literate, but they might have a nephew who is. And there is support, there is mutual support there. And I'm sure, you know, the more technically literate person will be very happy to help the less digitally literate person set up their privacy settings and make things better. As we collectively understand those issues are important, we can mutually support each other, and that can be very powerful.
So the future of the data economy will be made together.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking the time to visit the studio and sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Rise to Shine Futures podcast. In our previous episodes, we have searched answers to the questions like, how can I create systems change? And whether the crumbling world trade might be a start for a new era of circular economy. You can find us both on Spotify and Apple Podcasts by our Finnish name, Hyvää huomista, Tulevaisuus Podcast, as well as on the Sitra webpage at the address sitra.fi/podcast. Welcome aboard.